Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are we ready on the back straight? Are we ready on the home straight? Over to you, Mr. Starter.
Hello and welcome to the Rouleur podcast for issue 56. I'm Ian Parkinson, and for this podcast I'm joined by the journalist and author Max Leonard and Rouleur's editor Ian Cleverley. Welcome, gentlemen. First of all, I should say where I'm welcoming you to, because we're here on a slightly windy day at the legendary Herne Hill Velodrome in South London. The Velodrome was the home to the 1948 Olympics. It was nearly closed down a few years ago, threatened with closure because it needed a new track surface, but now it's been, thanks to the work of hundreds of volunteers, it's been restored. New track surface, new fence, new lighting, and awaiting next year, hopefully, a new pavilion. Ian, I know you are familiar with Herne Hill. We've ridden here together on occasion.
I've been coming down here for decades. Yeah, I like the sound of all that new everything now. I need new legs, sadly. But apart from that, it's getting there, isn't it? It's getting there.
It is getting there, and it's an amazing place, isn't it? There's something about that. It's kind of steeped in British cycling history, isn't it? There's a real atmosphere here.
It is. Well, you know, people that have ridden down here over the years, from Onk Teal to Tommy Simpson to, you know, it's amazing, amazing history, and the Olympics, of course.
Max, have you ridden here? Are you familiar with Herne Hill?
I've ridden here just a handful of times, and that was quite a long time ago, and probably the last time I was down actually was for the when Rollapalooza were running the Muddy Hell cyclocross, and it definitely looks very different now, and the new surface looks great.
Yeah, it's a shame that the Muddy Hell only happened a couple of times, actually, wasn't it? Because it did bring a different sort of atmosphere to the place.
It's a great race, great race. If you've never raced in the dark, it's extraordinary. I don't know what it is about racing in the dark, but it kind of makes you feel like you're going much faster.
Yeah, we're racing here with the new floodlights as well. Is a little bit spooky because you get weird shadows coming over your shoulder when the lights come on, and that takes a bit of getting used to as well.
I mean, weird shadows as in like ghosts of cyclists past.
Actually, in my case, it's normally just people overtaking me. If people aren't overtaking, it feels as if they are. Let me tell you what we have on this edition of the Rouleur podcast. Max, you're here. Max Leonard, you're here largely because you've written a fascinating story about the French rider of the 30s and 40s, René Vietto. More specifically, you've written a story about his toe.
Yeah, René Vietto's toe is one of those weird legends that the Tour, above and beyond many races, kind of seems to attract. Briefly, the story goes that René, in 1947 Tour, injured his toe somehow, and his toe went septic, and it was amputated rather than him abandoning the race. The Tour stopped in Nice that year, or in Monaco, and he went to Nice, where his doctor was, and had it taken off and then carried on.
And the story from that point on actually gets a bit weirder, doesn't it? And there are all kinds of myths.
There's some twists and turns in it, but there was just enough of a grain of truth in it that I thought it was worth investigating. It was kind of hung around so long that I thought, well, someone's got to go and try and find this toe.
And we'll talk to you a little bit more about that later on, including lots of other stories about René Vietto, because he was a deeply eccentric man in many ways, wasn't he?
He was. He's one of someone also who seemed to attract weird stories like that, and actually the photos on the piece bring that out. There's a lot of weird photos of him there too, so that was very pleasing to see.
Okay, and there's a bit of a cliffhanger about his toe, which we won't reveal now, but we will towards the end of the podcast. We'll also be choosing our favourite photographs from this issue of Rouleur. We'll be talking about the Dauphiné, taking a look at what else is in the magazine, and of course there's the Rouleur competition as well. First of all though, Ian, I was very jealous of you recently when you said you were off to meet the amazing Hannah Grant.
Yeah, she's got a new cookbook out, as I'm sure lots of people are aware, because it's kind of everywhere, the Grand Tour cookbook. And I've met Hannah before. I met her on the Vuelta last year, and when I did a piece on a lot of the Grand Tour chefs, I was fascinated by the whole idea of these guys, mostly Danish, but for some reason. But 10 years ago, they didn't exist. Teams didn't have them. They went to hotels and they put up with whatever slot was put in front of them. And now you've got people like Hannah and Soren at Team Sky. They're putting, like, really, really good quality food on the plates every night for the riders, and it's amazing stuff.
If anyone doesn't know, Hannah's the chef of the Saxo Tinkoff team. She posts on social media as Daily Stews, and I think she currently has around 11,000 followers on Twitter, mainly because she just posts loads of pictures of amazing looking food that she's serving up to the riders.
Well, that's the key. It's when I did the feature on the chefs, I started off saying, you know, you get home from work at 7 o'clock or 7:30 or whatever, you're knackered, you look in the fridge, you kind of think about what you're going to cook, and it's like, can I be bothered? And then you think, I'll just have a quick look on Twitter, and then you see what they've done, and you just I give up, you know. But I have tried, I think we've done about half a dozen things out of a book so far, and every one has been an absolute corker.
Yeah, I've done a few as well, and as you say in the interview that we're going to hear with Hannah in a moment, my kids in particular, when they first see fruit in salad with tuna and stuff, they look
wrong,
wrong. But then they eat it, and they get it. You went along to meet Hannah Grant, and one of the things she told you was that she didn't just cook the food and write the recipes for a book.
Took the pictures, edited them. It was a lot of work to do it all, because it has to look fresh, you know. There's no fake food styling in it. All the food that's in it has actually been edible. So it's to keep it fresh and good looking.
Yeah.
And then pictures, and then next dish.
And then eat it.
It was crazy, but it was worth it.
Was it hard work cutting through what recipes should go in and what should leave out? And
I did the Tour de France, and I wrote down the entire menu through the Tour de France, so I had it roughly out, and then I sat and I looked at it. Of course, in a cookbook, you don't want dishes that are too similar. So, of course, you know, with 2 weeks from each other, if I'd done two dishes that were too similar, I'd change that out, take dishes in from a different race, and so on. But everything in the book has been cooked for the riders at a certain point.
Because you do a lot of chicken, don't you? But you do a lot of chicken. You do chicken every day on the race.
Every day, yeah. It's kind of like the animal or the protein that everybody can agree on to like, if they're not feeling adventurous with eating fish or lamb or whatever as the alternative is. So, you know, no matter what nationality or personality you are, you can always go for the safe bet, chicken, if you're not in the mood for the other option.
You will supply an alternative.
Yeah,
for those,
there's always an alternative, because they go crazy. If I only serve chicken, they will go crazy.
Yeah.
But if it's not there, they will go equally crazy.
Cooking for riders on the road has come a long way in, I think we're talking 10 years now, since Bjørn Riis came up with the idea.
Yeah, I mean, the old school way of thinking food for riders was chicken and pasta, preferably really dry chicken, and pasta and ketchup. So what we work with is incorporating lots of veggies, lots of cold-pressed fats, good lean proteins, and then encouraging the riders to mix up the dense cups. So it's not only pasta, but we do potatoes, lentils, quinoa, brown rice, like all kinds of other options, because it is quite hard on the digestive system to only eat pasta.
I can't remember if this was you or Soren from Sky. Do you do sort of big treats on the rest day so that the riders have got something to look forward to?
I don't think Sky gets any treats ever. Tinkoff Saxo gets treats when they do well.
Okay, yeah. it's you that said that.
The night before the rest day, we'll do like a nice comfort meal for them. Usually we do like a build-your-own burger, super thin, crusty pizza. So it's kind of like it's the night where they can sit, relax, knowing that tomorrow there's not a grueling stage waiting. They can, you know, have some fun and for a few hours feel like they're not in the middle of this crazy, super hot bike race.
I'll tell you what I've been through so far, having had the book for a week, is we had the Moroccan chicken, which was fabulous at the weekend. Coconut chicken, except we replaced the sort of Thai style thing, except we replaced the chicken with the salmon because my daughter doesn't eat meat.
It's perfect.
Last night, asparagus, soft boiled eggs, and capers. But I did overdo the eggs slightly, which was kind of disappointing.
But you know what? Get to do it again.
Exactly. Next time, I will get it.
Better tweet
on.
It.
Better on. Yeah. Just needs to come out a minute earlier, and I probably didn't plunge them cold enough for.
That's the thing. Yeah.
And the other one, which was a cracker, was broccoli, walnuts, and blackberries, which my kids normally go, "What are we doing with fruit? In with the vegetables." Why blackberries?
They're beautiful, they're tasty, they're juicy. It's also a way of kind of like adding some, like a little bit of sweet and tangy depth and flavors to the dishes. So it's not only broccoli. You kind of like get more, you kind of like lift the broccoli's flavor, you know, when adding acidity and sweetness to it. But it's kind of like, I mean, you know, it looks inviting, it looks beautiful. It's interesting, it's different. It's not just, you know, boring old broccoli again.
Now, one thing you've told me previously, which I couldn't get my head around, is that it's possible for riders to put on weight during a grand tour. Tell me how that works.
Yeah, it is crazy. It's crazy. I mean, the stages every day aren't equally long. They're not all the same. And it's easy for a rider to just click off the thoughts and just go automatic and eat the same food every day. So, and then when they're on the bike again, they actually take in a lot of energy and bars, gels, little sandwiches, drinks and so on. So the balance between loading up, getting ready for the next day and not overdoing it, gaining weight, is very, very fine. If I know there's a short stage the day after, we'll kind of like keep it a little less on the dense carbs and kind of try and remind them, you know, tomorrow, guys, you don't need to bulk up like super crazy. Because when you're down to the details of having a fat percentage of, you know, 4, 4.5, it is, you know, tiny, 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 tiny bits of extra weight that'll, you know, make the difference whether you make it over the mountain fast enough or not.
Finally, when you reach Paris at the end of 3 weeks, you must be dead on your feet. Do you just go and lie down for 3 days and in a quiet, dark room?
I don't cook for 3 days, for sure. I can tell you that. You need rest, for sure. And you need someone else to cook for you when you get home.
Good. Well, good luck with getting somebody to cook for you when you get home.
Thank you.
Have a good tour.
Thank you so much.
So that was Hannah Grant of Team Saxo Tinkoff, and her Grand Tour cookbook is out now, as is also Velo Chef by Henrik Orr of Team Sky. I haven't seen that one. Have you seen
it? I've not seen it yet, no.
I guess there's always been, hasn't there, a sort of obsession amongst cyclists with food. If you get two or three cyclists together, eventually they will start talking about food.
Well, there is an obsession, but what's interesting is how it's changed. You know, when I were a lad, it were fig rolls and jam butties, basically. And
that was, if you were lucky.
A lot, yeah.
Even so, there's still two schools of thought, isn't there? At least among amateurs, there's people who really go for the high quality, best thinking, you know, nutritional ideas, and others who just take cycling a lot as an excuse to eat all the time and whatever they like.
Hannah hinted at something in that interview, actually, when she was talking about the sort of fat levels of professional cyclists now and the extraordinary advantage that people are trying to gain now by bringing their body weight and their power to weight ratio so low. There's almost an air of eating disorder about professional cycling and about many professional cyclists.
I think that's an ongoing thing that we'd like to do something on in the future, that we've been talking about doing. It's getting quite ridiculous. But as a human freak myself, who happens to have 1% body fat, and I have no choice in that, I can eat until I'm going to explode. I still have 1% body fat. I don't know. Is it dangerous? I don't feel like I'm. I kind of feel like if I'm really going for a big ride, and like I haven't got the reserves that other people have got to call on, maybe. I don't know if it works like that.
I guess it's dangerous if your body is not designed like that in the first place. I think, yeah, you are one of those people who's
freak,
naturally...
Yeah.
No, I think you're naturally slender, Ian. but some people aren't designed to be like that. Yeah, I'm certainly not. But I remember reading, I can't remember whose wife it was, but there was some professional cyclist's wife was saying that during the sort of middle of the season, sort of, you know, after a couple of grand tours, she can actually see the internal organs in her husband's back as he leant forward. You know, the internal organs were sort of poking through the skin he had so little fat on. And that sort of... I was watching Chris Froome climbing only the other day, and he is a... I know he's naturally slender, but he's a stick man these days, isn't he? His arms are painfully thin.
Brad Wiggins as well, when he's at tall weight, it's scary. Scary thing to see. Yeah, it doesn't look altogether healthy, but...
Yeah, because even if you talk to, you know, relatively recent riders like Dave Miller, they will say that when they started, actually, even though France and Italy have reputations as great culinary nations, the food they used to get in French and Italian hotels is pretty rubbish a lot of the time.
Even following the tour, it becomes an ordeal of nutrition. You can probably get a half-decent steak frites in most places, but the trouble is that's really all you can get. So you just have... It's kind of a monoculture where you go to 20 minor towns around France and you just... eat the same thing and it's not very good, and it takes its toll after a couple of weeks.
And then, of course, there's the other side. There's, you know, people like Jacques Anquetil, who, you know, would normally start the day with a couple of pheasants and a bottle of decent Burgundy before a race. And in fact, Jacques Anquetil raced here, did some exhibition races here at Herne Hill in 1964, and Cycling Weekly, or Cycling as it then was, were particularly interested in his diet, and they said before his races Jacques ate hors d'oeuvre, sausages, meat and salad, sweetbreads in cream sauce with creamed spinach and fresh fruit, and he drank spa water and coffee. You can almost hear the sort of sneering at what the foreigners would get up to in that quote, can't you?
Unbelievable. And all that lot stayed down.
We assume so. On that? Well, I want to know is where he got sweetbreads in cream sauce with cream spinach in Herne Hill. René Vietto, and we will talk in more detail about his toe shortly. He had some unorthodox views on food and drink as well, didn't he, Max?
Yeah, he didn't seem to like eating at all. He didn't like sleeping either, but eating was a particular enemy. And he'd take, once he was kind of team leader, he'd take people on 300-kilometre plus training rides and force them not to eat. And when one of his domestique one day said, "Look, I just can't go on," he said, "Well, eat grass." And I think the guy actually had to, which was...
Didn't he once attempt to ride around France with no food at all, effectively, because he thought that food wasn't necessary for nutrition?
Yeah, after he retired as a racer, he did try this... Well, he planned this incredible stunt. He did become convinced that you needed just vitamins and other nutritional aids, and that we actually didn't need food. So he'd planned a 7-day Tour de France, so it was a long kind of, 400, 500K Audax style stages each day, but he planted it only with a musette full of pills and stuff like that.
But someone talked him out of that, presumably.
Well, history does not record the why he didn't do it, but I think it's safe to say it's probably better that he didn't do it.
Right, favourite photographs then. Max, which photograph in this edition, number 56, caught your eye?
Well, the one that I picked is by Michael Blann, and it's of Romain Bardet, and it's the first one in Michael Blann and Andy McGrath's article on Bardet, and it's taken at his home in Clermont-Ferrand. It's got some interesting lighting in it, but really it's just nice because he's such an unlikely figure, Bardet, for a cycling prodigy. He looks a little bit kind of scarecrowish in it. He's got a cardigan on. It's a bit schoolboyish, and it's just very different from his demeanour on the bike, I think, is what I like about it. I guess if you remember him in the Dauphiné, and descending the Col d'Alos and attacking it just seems very at odds with what you see on the bike and what you see off. But he seems like a really nice guy in the interview, and I've got a soft spot for him and for Clermont-Ferrand because I used to live there. That's where he lives and where he's from and where he trains, so it was great to see the pictures.
Ian, how about you?
Well, I've got a soft spot for team time trials, which is why we've got a whole gallery of team time trials to kick off the magazine. I just think they're wonderful things. Marshall Cappell, who this is the first thing he's done for us in the magazine. He's also done the feature on the Dauphiné, but he's done all these amazing team time trial shots, and the one that really struck me first was the one of Etix Quick Step. He's head on, they're in tight formation, they're coming through the trees, and there's a light shining through from behind that presumably is coming from the following car, that just sets the whole thing off beautifully. And it's just the way they're so tight together, I know, that it's just like, for me, it's the perfect.
It's an amazing thing to watch a team time trial, isn't it? It's always the sort of slightly unfashioned. People always moan about team time trials for some reason, that they're they're a slightly dull spectacle, but they are an amazing thing to watch.
Beats an individual time trial, hands down.
It can also be quite entertaining to watch it done badly as well.
Oh, yeah, when it falls apart.
It's really amazing how many pro teams really can't get a team time trial together on their own.
Well, when I was putting the picks together, and I was sort of dimly recalled disastrous team time trial from a few years back in the Tour, Montpellier, where they were coming off the road left, right and centre. There was a couple of particular corners, and there was half the team going into a field, there was people crashing on a second corner, they were coming down, and it was carnage, absolute nightmare. Nobody enjoys watching crashing, really, do they? But it's just when a team time trial goes badly wrong, it is quite fun. And when it goes right as well, actually, a team that really gets it right is a wonderful thing to watch.
I'm going to cheat slightly because I'm going to choose the same picture, favourite picture, as Ian Stannard, which is the one of Cipollini's 97 Cannondale.
With
his name on.
The oldie Spinergies.
It's just gorgeous. It's one of those bikes that sort of just sums up an era for me, Beppe Cerone's Colnago. It accompanies an article about Cannondale, which I think is really interesting. I think Cannondale are quite an interesting brand, aren't they? Because although they're American, they really have a kind of Euro sensibility about them, unlike some of the other American bike brands. They are partly, I suspect, because of their association with teams like Seiko. They're a little bit more European and flash than some of the other American brands, I think. Let's talk about René Vietto's toe. Max, what was it that kind of attracted you to the story in the first place?
I guess it's something that you read in Tour history books, and there's anyone who's got into it a bit will know that there's books that are very well researched and very well done, and there's some books that are just full of the same stories mentioned over and over again, and probably most of them aren't true, or they're not, mostly not factual. And this toe story seemed to turn up in good books and in bad books, but no one had really ever looked into it, and I like these stories about the Tour. I mean, I don't mind that mostly they're not true. They're things that we believe about the Tour anyway, and that says as much about the race as if Abdelkader Zaf, which was another one I researched into at one point, the Algerian who drank a bottle of wine and went the wrong way. Maybe, you know, that's maybe not quite the truth of it all, but, you know, it's a story everyone knows, and that says something about the tour anyway.
So. I think we sort of forget, don't we, quite how much of the history of the tour in the early days was basically made up to sell newspapers, wasn't it? Because no one could check.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, well, I think that's part of the early races, that once the tour was through, the only record of it was in the paper. And we've got a great record of amazing photos and stage reports right from the first ever day of the race. But, you know, that in the end becomes the history. But, yeah, the toe was, and it's, sorry for the pun, it was a footnote in several people's books. And I just thought, well, you know, it keeps on turning up in all these histories. It would probably be worth having a look, see if it's actually there. And
because the story was that his toe was chopped off. But not actually disposed of. It ended up in a jar in some bar in Marseille. That was the story.
Yeah, the story went that he had it chopped off on the rest day, completed the tour, and that the toe was preserved in formaldehyde, put in a jar, and was kept behind a bar in Marseille.
And didn't he try and convince Apo Lazaridis, who was one of his domestiques, to chop his toe off as well so that he could share the suffering?
Yeah, that's the second half of the story. And that one I was always more sceptical about, because I think the version I read was that he was doing it to convince Apo Lazaridis, or to show him the pain and suffering necessary to win the tour, and the sacrifices you had to make. But given that Vietto never won the tour, I just thought it was a bit spurious. And in fact, Vietto is pretty much famous for not winning the tour.
Well, he was famous sort of in one of the tours in the 30s, wasn't it? 34, I think, for having to sacrifice his own chances for his team leader, Antonin Magne, when Magne had a mechanical problem or something.
Yeah, and this is one of those things that's precisely what we were saying about the legends made around the tour, and there's a great photo of it in the article. Vietto sitting on a wall crying because he's given his front wheel to his team leader. I think it happened twice. There were two separate instances, and both in the Pyrenees, one the day after the other. And the first time he gave his wheel, the second time he actually gave his bike, and Antonin Magne ended up winning the tour. Lots of people think Vietto sacrificed his chance as a 20-year-old to, you know, take the yellow jersey and win himself. And there's this great photo of Vietto on a wall crying with a bike with no front wheel. But the version actually used in Rouleur is, I think anyway, the one that shows that Jacques Godet is standing right next to him. And Godet was the assistant director of the tour, and he was also the main journalist writing up for L'Auto every day. And I think you can tell it's him because he used to wear a pith helmet. That was his signature. And apparently he spotted this as a kind of, for the propaganda potential of it straight away.
It's a great story, yeah.
Yeah, and printed it the next day. And that kind of sealed Vietto's reputation and made his fame as the, you know, the guy who, you know, nobody sacrificed his chances for his team leader.
So how did you go about tracking down, or first of all, checking the truthfulness, but secondly, tracking down René Vietto's toe?
A lot of internet research to begin with. A lot of forums full of old French guys who are, you know, full of memorabilia and people showing off collections of bikes, talking about old bikes that they have, that kind of thing. And the other lucky reference I found actually was in an article from 2013 written by Jeremy Whittle. He mentioned the name of René Bertrand, who was an old friend of Vietto's, and was his bike shop was one that the René Vietto brand bikes were sold through.
He was effectively René Vietto's greatest fan.
Yes, he was. He was born actually 14 years to the day after Vietto, and remember seeing him race into Marseille during the 1934 tour when Vietto became a superstar. And he said from that moment on, it was, you know, all about Vietto. And Bertrand, he was a very interesting guy. He was a directeur sportif for Mercier in the 60s, so he was Poulidor's DS and Barry Hoban, I think, as well. And his bike shop that he eventually opened with his brother in Marseille was a dealer for Bartali bikes as well, so he was big friends with Bartali, and Vietto was really his main man, and they had a lifelong friendship.
Most important question, though, does he have René Vietto's toe?
I'm not sure we should divulge that, do you think, Max?
You're going to have to make people buy the
I'm going to take my editor's advice here and leave it be right now.
I think we hang on to that one. And all I would say in closing on this matter is that Max's research did seem to involve drinking a lot of rosé and pastis in various bars of Marseille. Yeah.
The game plan until I actually found René Bertrand and, you know, followed that lead up on the internet was just to go to Marseille and try a few bars and see if any had kind of a jar with a toe in.
Happened to have a tour rider's toe behind the bar.
Yeah, you know, among the pickles and the crisps and that kind of thing. But no, luckily I had a better lead than that, but it didn't stop me going and having a little drink just for you know, symbolic purposes.
Okay, so if you want to find out whether Max ever did find Renovieto's toe and what's happened to it, you're going to have to buy Edition 56. What do you think, finally, what do you think the story of Renovieto and his toe and all these other eccentricities, what do you think that tells us about the tour?
It's interesting this year because there's a lot, you know, it's the anniversary of, well, 30th anniversary of Bernard Hinault's last win, and we have all the, we have Bardet, we've got Pinot, and all this younger generation coming up, and as we speak, they're actually not doing all that well in this year's tour. But even so, you know, it seems like a good moment for French cycling. But Vietto's a funny guy because, he, you know, his palmarès wasn't actually all that great. He's known not exactly for his failure, but he's not known for winning. And it's one of those funny things. Well, why is he remembered, whereas and fated so much, whereas more talented or more successful people aren't? And it's, I think it's quite revealing about the French attitude to the race.
The French do love a brave loser, don't they? Mm.
It's something that also comes up in the Romain Bardet piece, where he was awarded best French finisher, you know, a couple of years ago, and he's spitting feathers about it. It's just like, I don't want, you know, there's still a whole load of people who finished in front of me. It means nothing to me. And there is that kind of brave loser mentality thing, which needs to be overcome, I would say.
Okay, we're nearly at the end of this podcast. Competition, Ian.
Oh, yes. Competition for last issue, which was issue 55. The winner for that... Oh, I can't remember what the question was. I know what the question was. The question was, how many times has the La Sainte de Montvernier climb been used in the Tour de France? Which, of course, is none. Or, you know, this is the first time. The winner of a swanky new white Rulo T-shirt is David Parmeter, from Wiltshire, and as he's from Wiltshire, good on you, same as me.
And what's the question for this edition?
The question for this edition is based around Martin Proctor's fabulous illustration, which is about the 40th year of the Champs-Élysées being the finish of the Tour de France, celebrating that. The question is simply, who will win on the Champs-Élysées, the final stage on the Sunday? So obviously you've got to get your entries in before
the final
stage.
The final day of the Tour.
Please. Entries go to competition@ruler.cc, and I should also mention what the lucky winner will get, which is a fabulous print by Richard Mitchelson of his Z cover from issue 16.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
It is a lovely, lovely print. And the winner will get one of those.
Okay, Ian Cleverly, thanks very much. Max Leonard, thanks. That's it for this edition of the Ruler podcast for edition 56. Thanks for joining us here at Herne Hill Velodrome. The Grand Tour Cookbook by Hannah Grant is available online, as is Lanterne Rouge by Max Leonard. And if you want to help with the continued revival and survival of Herne Hill Velodrome, go online and search for the Friends of Herne Hill Velodrome. You can sign up to membership or to make a donation. That's it. I'm Ian Parkinson. See you next edition.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.